BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Welcome to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The Briefing Room. It's you, it's me, it's a big issue, top experts, and 28 minutes to get informed. And this week, China, where there's an energy and property crisis. What's going on? China seems to be in a spot of economic bother. GDP figures have dropped significantly, and the country has also been experiencing an energy shortage, with factories having to stop production and homes being plunged into the dark. And as the saying almost goes, when China catches a cold, the rest of us will all need a hanky. So what's going on, and how worried should we be? Step into the briefing room. Together we'll find out. Let's start with an overview. Joining me in the briefing room is the BBC's Asia Pacific editor, Celia Hatton. Celia Hatton, how significant is the Chinese economic slowdown, especially if we compare it with what's gone before?
Well, I think, yeah, we have to put this into context to look at the big numbers that we're used to seeing coming out of China. I mean, but since China began opening up in 1978, we're used to double-digit increases in expansion of its economy every year. And so now we're seeing those big numbers. They have been slowing down for quite some time. There's less productivity. We have an aging workforce. We've got, of course, the ongoing trade disputes with the United States. But against those medium and long-term issues that are dragging those big numbers down, Chinese leaders are confronting their first major economic crisis in a while. And that's really forced them into the uncomfortable position of having to reassure disgruntled, angry Chinese citizens and investors. They're not used to having to do that.
What's behind this, for China, significant slowdown?
Overall, China's very powerful leader, Xi Jinping, is trying to exert greater control over the Chinese economy. He's tackling monopolies, especially China's technology giants. And the mood just isn't as welcoming to foreign investment as before. Add to that, we've got twin crises happening right now. There's an energy crisis in China that's led to power plant shutdowns. And there's also the threat of a possible collapse in the property market, which props up a lot of China's economic growth and investment.
Are any of these impacting directly upon ordinary Chinese people?
Absolutely. Both of those things affect ordinary Chinese people every day. The energy crisis, of course, because we're seeing power plant shutdowns across huge sections of China. This is taking place as many parts of China are experiencing unusually cold weather. And so we're hearing stories of people in China shivering in their apartments. They have no heating or no electricity, for example. There's a famous video circulating around China showing a family with very young children stuck in an elevator in their apartment block because there was no electricity to run the elevator. So you see images of terrified children cowering on the floor of an elevator. Add that to the property crisis. Many Chinese people, the only way they have to invest money is to buy property. And it's not just Evergrande, the second largest property company, that's in trouble. Together, it's estimated that China's property developers are believed to have an outstanding debt of more than 3.6 trillion pounds.
Is COVID still a factor?
Yeah, COVID is a huge factor because China's borders are really still quite closed off to the rest of the world. There was some talk a few weeks ago that China would begin to reopen when 85% of the population had received vaccines. We're at around 75% now. However, just in the past week or so, new lockdowns have been imposed so that Chinese officials can continue to pursue their zero COVID strategy. So we're seeing cities once again barring people from leaving, planes canceled, trains canceled. And so really, China's not looking at reopening its doors to the outside world anytime soon.
Now, this comes against the background of President Xi having a kind of new strategy for China, doesn't it?
Xi Jinping has been mentioning his common prosperity plan more and more often in the past few months. Now, it's a bit of a vague plan still, but it loosely carries on from a past pledge to completely eliminate extreme poverty by this year. Now, that was done. The party claims to have accomplished that. So common prosperity is the next promise, and that is loosely the idea that Xi Jinping wants to boost the middle class. He says he wants the wealth distribution of the population to resemble the shape of an olive, so with very few people at either end and kind of a plump middle. There's around 400 million people in the middle class at the moment. Xi Jinping wants that number to be far bigger. Now, critics say this really is a pretext so that he can impose greater party control over super rich private companies and private entrepreneurs. It gives him the license to be able to begin to intervene in those private businesses and to force them to hand over some of their wealth.
Celia Hatton. Now let's focus in on a couple of sectors that Celia talked about. First off, energy. Dr. Philip Andrews Speed is Senior Principal Fellow at the Energy Studies Institute of the National University of Singapore. Philip Andrews Speed, we heard earlier about scenes of people being stuck in lifts during power cuts and things like that. How would you characterise what's happening with regard to energy in China? Is it a crisis?
Yes, I think in fair terms it is a crisis. There is a temporary mismatch of supply of energy and demand. Demand is high and supply is not big enough, and so lots of electricity is being cut across the country. I think only in a small number of places, particularly in the northeast, are people getting stuck in lifts and having to eat by candlelight. I think across much of the country, it is industry that is being turned off rather than households.
What is the explanation for this crisis?
I mean, beyond the fact there's a mismatch of supply and demand, I see it as a sort of collision between the state and the plan on one side and the market on the other. If we go back to early last year, after COVID hit, the government had an economic recovery plan that was very much focused on high energy use industries, steel and cement and things like that, that would use lots of energy, bring lots of jobs and build lots of buildings and infrastructure. And this continued into the beginning of this year. At the same time, the government put caps on the amount of energy each province could use. And then you've got the market coming in, particularly the export market. So the rest of the world was demanding Chinese goods. And so energy use continued to climb. Now, over the same period, the country was closing a number of coal mines that were old. And that during this year, they've been suspending production at a number of coal mines that were unsafe or there was corruption or environmental problems. So there became a shortage of coal just as demand was going up and up. So coal prices went up. However, power prices, electricity prices, was not going up. And so as a result, the coal-fired power generators were either not buying coal or, if they did have coal, were not producing power because they were losing money with high coal prices and low power prices. And so it goes on. And you've also got weather against you. You had a long, cold winter, a very hot summer, both of which required more electricity to heat and to cool. And at the same time, in southwest China, you had a drought, so there was less hydroelectricity. So it was a perfect storm of the state, the market, and the weather all intervening.
Okay, so that would suggest that what you've got really is a blip, because once those perfect storm conditions die down, you won't get a repeat necessarily of all those things happening together, then the thing can be brought back into equilibrium.
Yes, I think the government is starting on this. Because most of the energy companies are state-owned, it can order them to produce more coal. It can order the power stations to buy the coal and produce more electricity. At the same time, it's allowed electricity prices to rise slightly, and it's trying to squeeze down by threatening people if they charge too much for coal. So this will start to work its way through. The problem is that winter is coming, and we've already had the heating systems turned on a month earlier than normal because it looks like to be a very cold winter. So again, this is going to take some months really to sort out.
In the China's plan, do you think that has derailed the plan for decarbonisation? Or do you think it has given emphasis to the need for an intensification of that plan?
Yeah, I think the priorities will remain. And as I say, I think this is temporary. By next spring, it will be sorted. And then, you know, the leadership will push through on their aim to peak carbon before 2030 and the more difficult task, carbon neutrality by 2060. So I think it will make them consider very carefully the role of coal and how they can accelerate the deployment and use of low carbon energy. So yes, governments have to react in the short term to deal with energy shortages, and the government has reiterated that its first priority is energy security, keeping the lights on and getting the factories going.
Philip Andrews Speed. The second troubled part of the Chinese economy that we touched on earlier was housing and property, where the headline has been the slide towards bankruptcy of the huge Chinese property developer Evergrande. To help us understand that better, I'm joined in the briefing room by George Magnus, an associate at Oxford University's China Centre. George Magnus, how big is the Chinese real estate market and how does it compare with other big countries?
It's huge. It was last estimated by a major investment bank in about 2019 at around $52 or $53 trillion, which means that by now it's probably around $54-55 trillion. So that makes it four times as big as China's economy, twice as big as America's real estate market, and about five times as big as Britain's. So huge.
We've heard of Evergrande being in trouble. Now, what's gone wrong for them?
Basically, Evergrande is bankrupt, in effect. Pinching an expression from Ernest Hemingway's book, The Sun Also Rises, where one of the characters is asked, how did you go bankrupt? And he says, gradually and then suddenly. And this is really what's happened to Evergrande and to a number of other property developers. They've been borrowing a lot of money over the last 10 or 15 years. Evergrande has over $300 billion of liabilities.
So who's Evergrande in debt to?
Well, Evergrande owes quite a lot of money to foreign investors, banks, insurance companies, hedge funds, mutual funds, and so on. And in fact, it's missed a couple of interest payments to foreign investors already. There is a grace period, but this grace period runs out actually on this weekend. If the payments aren't made, then effectively the company will be in default. But it also owes a lot of money to Chinese investors, of course. So Chinese banks, China's financial institutions. One suspects that actually foreign creditors will certainly be on the hook much sooner, at a much greater extent, really, than domestic creditors. I do think that domestic creditors will also have to pay a price, but probably not the customers, the citizens, because that would be politically a bridge too far for Xi Jinping and the Communist Party, I think.
Going back to 2008, it was debt from the property market which was a big factor in the crash. Is there any kind of similar risk of that kind of contagion in the case of Evergrande and potentially other property companies in trouble?
Probably not other property companies, because they're relatively small by comparison. There has been chat, I should say, about whether this is China's Lehman's moment, referring, of course, to the bankruptcy of the American bank Lehman in 2008, which spawned, really, the financial crisis and the deep recession that followed. But I think that's unlikely. One would never say impossible, but I think it's unlikely to happen in China's case, because in a state-controlled and owned banking system, the government really controls all the actors, banks, insurance companies, financial intermediaries, can all be manipulated or instructed to take on Evergrande's liabilities. It's a little bit easier. I'm not saying it's easy, but it's a little bit easier to stage manage a restructuring of the property sector and of the company without necessarily triggering the kind of contagion that we saw in liberal-leaning democracies and the world economy in 2008-2009.
In that case, what would you say are the biggest dangers for the Chinese economy arising out of the Evergrande bankruptcy, if it happens?
China's property sector, including investment in construction, housing services like renting, buying, managing property, and the inputs that go into apartments and houses like steel, cement, copper, consumer durable goods, and so on. If you add all of this up, it comes to about 29% of China's national income. That's about double what it is for the typical developed market economy. So if 29% of national income is going to stagnate for the next decade, which it well might, I think not only will the Chinese economy feel that very, very cold wind, but probably the rest of us too, to the extent that we export or rely on exporting a lot of goods to China.
If I were a foreign investor looking at my position in China, looking at the Evergrande problem, I would probably be thinking, is this place as good a bet as I once assumed it was?
The housing market actually is one very important area where the Chinese government thinks that people are being fleeced by unaffordable prices. So they are almost certainly going to take more control back in the housing market as part of their wider program of clamping down on private sector firms and private entrepreneurs and make these companies kind of serve what the party believes are its hallowed social and moral goals. So as an investor, you need to look at China in a very different way in the future.
George Magnus. So we've got slowing growth, large debts, and a hopefully temporary energy crisis in China. What can and will the Chinese leadership do about this? And how will it impact on the rest of the world? I'm joined from Washington, D.C. by Tom Orlick, who is chief economist at Bloomberg. He's the author of China, the Bubble That Never Pops, and Dr. Keyu Jin, associate professor of economics at the London School of Economics. Tom Orlick, we've heard about China's energy shortage and the overheated real estate sector. But why has this all come to a head now?
So in 2020, China had huge success in containing its COVID outbreak and getting its economy going again faster than almost any other economy in the world. In 2021, building on that success, President Xi decided it was time to take on some other challenges. Managing down risk in the financial sector, in the real estate sector, making a down payment on addressing the challenge of climate change. Unfortunately, the confluence of all of those pressures, continued risks from COVID, weaker loan growth, a slowing real estate sector, and now an energy shortage, has really significantly slowed China's economy. In the third quarter, the economy really came screeching to a halt, and the expectation is that they'll head into the fourth quarter and 2022 on a weak footing as well.
So are we describing a combination of policy decisions together with much more unforeseen problems?
This is a troubling moment for China's economy. If there's one thing that could end the Chinese growth story, it's a collapse in the real estate sector, triggering a financial crisis. One of the reasons why I am optimistic that that is not going to happen is because the problems we're seeing right now reflect a deliberate policy choice by Beijing. Beijing has decided that it's time to squeeze some of the air out of a bubbly real estate sector. And so if we see the economy sliding into recession, if we see the beginnings of what looks like a financial crisis, Beijing is going to turn the direction of policy and pump up growth again, at least in the short term.
Dr. Keyu Jin, is that broadly how you see it, that to put it crudely, the dash for growth was too ambitious, it got too baked in, people in China became too addicted to it, and there have had to be some adjustments made?
I think there is a slowdown in long-term growth, but that is in some ways planned. China's old model of investing in smokestack industries, growing at 10% per year, citizens getting wealthier and wealthier by the day, that's the old Chinese model. And the reality is it is entering a slower growth phase just because it's grown so long, so fast, And also because the government has changed and shifted some of its priorities away from GDP growth and more focusing on social welfare, societal harmony, consumer welfare, consumer protection, less about efficiency and growth and more about reducing inequality and the so-called common prosperity, which is the most popular term nowadays in China.
In the meantime, there are big problems of transition, and one which concerns us here in this programme is the one about debt, as evidenced in the real estate sector. Tom Orlick, is there any danger, do you think, that there could be a repeat in China of previous debt-fuelled crashes?
The risk is certainly there, David. Before the great financial crisis back in 2008, China's debt-to-GDP ratio was low and stable. In the last decade and more, it's rocketed upward. And if we look at what's happened to other countries in the world, which have seen a big increase in debt, often that's been followed by financial crisis. The difference in China is that almost all of the debt is funded domestically. That means China doesn't have the same vulnerability that Korea in 1997 or Latin American countries at various points in the last few decades have had when foreign investors decide to pull out their money and the system collapses. The second big difference in China is that, again, in contrast to many other countries, China's leaders from Xi Jinping down have acknowledged the problem and started to move aggressively to deal with it. That doesn't guarantee that they're going to be successful, but it gives them a better chance.
I have to say, the way in which you both set this is very interesting, because what it suggests is, yes, there are things that come together to give this the appearance of a crisis, but actually the government has this well in hand. That's hard to square when you look at a major real estate company going bankrupt, KU Jin. Are we looking at this in the wrong way, or is there a bigger problem than people care to admit?
No, the financial risk associated with a property price decline or the collapse of a big property company is significant. More than half of the banking assets are tied to the real estate, and more than 75% of household wealth is tied to real estate. But I think the major difference that we have to keep in mind with the Western Byzantine complex system in finance, especially in the US and in Europe, is that financial markets are not yet that deep. There are not eight layers of connections, as was the case in the US. These interlinkages are there, but they're not as complex and not as opaque. So even if the property company does suffer from a major collapse, it will affect many parties, no doubt, but it's not going to be a financial calamity.
Tom Orlick, one of the advantages that China has in the way in which you're describing it is that the government has more tools at its disposal. Is that not also a risk? Because conceivably, the government strategy could be wrong.
It's not that hard to find examples of Chinese government intervention which have, frankly, catastrophic impacts on China's long-term growth prospects. The one-child policy introduced by Deng Xiaoping in the 1980s has built in a kind of demographic drag, which is guaranteed to lower China's growth rates in the years ahead. So government intervention can be a significant driver of growth, but it can also lock in some serious policy mistakes. In the current situation, where we're talking about a government's capacity to manage a potential crisis situation, though, I think having more levers is better than having less.
What about the impact of this crisis on the rest of the world?
China is now the second biggest economy in the world. China is the biggest source of demand for global commodities, from iron ore to coal to commodities like soybeans. China increasingly is a major source of investment spending for countries that are benefiting from the Belt and Road agenda. So a slowdown in China is a slowdown for the rest of the world. A crisis in China, and that's not where I think we're going, but we can't rule it out. Well, a crisis in China would also be a crisis for the rest of the world. Where's it going to impact? I think we can think about three concentric circles around China. The first group, the one to feel the biggest tremors, they're going to be China's Asian neighbors, Korea, Vietnam, and others. The second is going to be the big commodity exporters, Australia, Brazil, other countries that feed China's bellies and China's industrial engine. And the third group, the most insulated, but not by any means entirely insulated, are the big advanced economies, amongst them the United Kingdom.
Keijin, what do you think the impact of all this will be on China's commitment to decarbonisation?
The Chinese government is very resolute with this commitment, but it is often the case that the Chinese leadership issues a statement that displays this level of commitment, but the follow-up doesn't quite meet what is required. And that might well be the case also with the climate commitment. However, it is important to point out that the dedication to having a greener, cleaner economy and to invest in renewables and in the new energy sector is a real one. And we're seeing China take actions more intensely than elsewhere. We are seeing private companies having to even go bankrupt because of the strict and stringent environmental regulations. We are seeing local governments stopping to turn their localities into tourist areas, which raise revenue just to abide to the strict regulations for the environment. The Chinese people have to sort their own trash into four different bins every single night, and people comply. So it is a national effort, but whether we can meet this 2060 goal is still in question.
Tom Warnock, a lot of people would say without the 2060 goal being met, not just by China, but of course, by other countries in their own ways, the rest of this may not be worth that much.
So there's a saying from a Chinese leader, perhaps apocryphal, and that is that a little bit more imbalance is better than a lot of collapse. And I think what that captures is that for China's leaders, there are long-term goals like meeting climate change objectives, like de-risking the financial system, like managing the air out of the real estate bubble. And then there are short-term imperatives, like delivering enough jobs and enough growth to keep the economy going, to keep China's social system stable. Now, China's leaders always want to deliver on those long-term goals. They want to deliver on the decarbonization objective. But sometimes the necessity of the moment requires them to shift focus and look at short-term goals. I expect those short-term pressures to persist into the end of the year and into early 2022. But I also expect China's leaders, unusually, frankly, relative to some of their peers in other countries, to keep their eyes fixed on those long-term goals and to get back on track on the decarbonisation agenda, the deleveraging agenda, once they've righted the ship.
Tom Orlick there with Keiyu Jin. And if there's going to be a summary on something this big, I suppose it'd have to be, we think they'll sort it out. My thanks to Keiyu Jin, Tom Orlick, Celia Hatton, Philip Andrew Speed and George Magnus. We'll be back at the end of November. Goodbye. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The producers were John Murphy, Kirsty Knight and Soila Aparicio. The sound engineer was Graham Puddifoot. And the editor, for the last ever time, is Jasper Corbett. And if you enjoyed this podcast, you might like other editions of The Briefing Room, which are all available on BBC Sounds. Recently, we've explored what's happening to social care in the UK, the state of British rivers, and tensions over Taiwan.
That's the moment it hit me. I'm like, oh my gosh, I think I'm in a cult.
I used to think to myself, these people are mad, but until I realise that I'm mad as well.
I'm Paris Lees, and this is The Flip Side from BBC Radio 4. In each episode, I tell two stories from opposite sides of the coin. A new science to ask questions about elements of the human experience that we sometimes take for granted.
I know that we're genetically related, but in my mind, I don't have the feeling that we are necessarily kin.
My dad said, you know that we love you and I am your father, but...
Subscribe to The Flip Side with me, Paris Lees, on BBC Sounds.